Thank you very much, Commissioners, for inviting me to speak a bit about the food supply chain, and particularly with reference to UK food workers. And so it's again very nice to sort of meet everybody here as well today. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to set out more of a sort of big picture before going into some detail. So I want to discuss more generally the role of employment and jobs in the food sector. And I want to situate these within wider food supply so we can sort of understand some of the dynamics that are going on. And I also want to consider whether employment issues in the food sector are fundamentally different from wider structural problems within, you know, impacting the labour market more generally. And also I want to give some examples from some more recent research detailing specific problem areas in the food labour sector. So that's what I'm going to try and achieve in my 10 minutes. And there are some problems and characteristics. You know, when we think about the food sector and jobs and work, a lot that's going on in the food sector is also replicated in other sectors. So you can get sort of a bit carried away, sort of sometimes thinking that, you know, somehow the food is unique. And, you know, particularly, as I just wanted to point out, for example, in the UK, generally, compared to other developed world economies, has a really high number of low-paid, low-skilled jobs. And it's estimated around something like 5 million people, or one-fifth of the UK working population, comes under that sort of heading. So what impacts a food job as on other jobs? Pay, of course, that's, you know, sort of critical. Job security, that's a sort of a big issue. Progression, you know, skills, workplace training, careers. And job quality, you know, the working conditions in which, you know, the work takes place. And also important when you look at sort of these labour studies is trying to match job needs or potential employees with the needs of business, and business trying to, you know, engage with what they need in terms of people to move forward in their business. So there is a sort of automatically a dialogue in some way. And I just want to remind ourselves, you know, that you talk about, you know, the title of this hearing is the food supply chain, because to me it's quite important to understand the separate sectors that make up the food supply chain, but also some of the interaction. So, you know, so by, it's just a simple supply chain. So you have primary producers like agriculture, manufacturing, wholesalers, catering, and retailers. The examples I'm going to focus on today are going to be mainly being in this area on manufacturing processes in terms of some of the data. And again, the food sector is big and important part of the food economy. The sort of total consumer expenditure is around about 196 billion. Sort of 57% of that is roughly sort of from the household, and the rest, 43%, is sort of from catering. But also, when we can think of jobs and where our food comes from, I think the UK has one particular characteristic which is a bit different, is that only around 53% of the food that we eat in the UK is actually produced here domestically. So basically, we rely on what I call ghost workers to provide, you know, 47% of the rest of our food. And typically around 24 other countries, we rely on 24 countries to feed us. They supply about 90% of our UK food supply together with the UK. So in that sense, you know, we have this, you know, army of ghost workers, and, you know, as well as our UK issues. And when we think of where the employees are in the food chain, very important again for me to sort of not lose sight that, you know, how the food system, food supply chain changed fundamentally. So most workers are in that catering, restaurant and cafe area, about 1.4 million, or 40% of all employees in food. The next biggest section is food and drink retailing with about 1.13 million. And manufacturing is 10%. And agriculture, which includes fishery as well, it's only around about 400,000 people these days. And so in that sense, you know, we're very much like a service economy. And that's where some of the problems that we look at in terms of labour relations are specific to those sectors, but also there's some commonalities and some relationship between the two. And it's very important, again, to see how important this sector is. It's 13% of all UK employment. And also there's a difference in gender roles in the industry. So in terms of retailing and catering, sort of the workforce tends to be more dominated by the female workforce. In food manufacturing, it's still very dominated by a male workforce. And an important, another important thing in terms of the quality of jobs and the type of jobs and conditions is that roughly half of all food jobs in the food sector are part-time. And we have this ongoing debate, which I think I'll just raise this as an issue between the minimum wage and the living wage. Some evidence suggests that the UK minimum wage is more prevalent within the food sector than in other industry sectors. And one estimate I came across in preparing today is 6% in agricultural minimum wage. In manufacturing, it's 15%. In hospitality, it's around a quarter. So that's what I mean to say, to understand these sector dynamics. But it's not impossible to do the living wage. Just last year, Nestlé became an accredited living wage employer for its UK workforce. And so, how it was presented to the press was very much as a collaboration between the company and unions and other stakeholders. So, and it was described as a milestone in the campaign to tackle in-work poverty. So I think this is a sort of a very critical issue around pay. Also, I just want to now talk about a little bit of detail to dig down a bit by looking at food and drink manufacturers and processors. And here, the important point I want to make is that we need to perhaps understand sort of the dynamics of the structure of the food industry. In the sense, in terms of total number of companies and businesses, it's completely dominated by smaller companies. And so you have this sort of split between the giants of the food sector and the smaller companies. And in the European context, there's roughly 285,000 sort of food businesses in food and drink manufacturing. And of those, 99.1% are small and medium-sized enterprises. But when it comes to employment, that remaining 0.9% of businesses, they are responsible for 40% of all jobs in the food sector. And if you include in that the medium-sized companies and combine it with those bigger companies, that comes to about 5% of all companies. They are responsible for 2/3 of the employment in the food sector. So again, you have these sort of different industry-sized dynamics going on. And this is from a study that was undertaken over a year ago, looking at the European Union food and drink manufacturing sector. And some of the trends that were seen across the European countries is very sort of, so you see that sort of replicated in the UK case. And so there's a growth in temporary contracts at the expense of permanent appointments. So again, these are all things probably you're familiar with, but this is just confirming it. And this is not voluntary. This is often presented as because people want flexible time, flexible working conditions for families or whatever. But this research showed that actually the workers did not want this, this was forced upon them. And also, obviously for being here, we're very conscious of the role of migrant workers and their importance. But this is a trend throughout Europe as well. And they've become an important workforce in the European sort of setting. And there's roughly around, in food and drink manufacturing, around 400,000 migrant workers. And that's a doubling in the number of migrant workers over the past 10 years or so.
Is that in the whole of the EU or just in...
Yes, the 27, I think. EU 27. This is food and drink manufacturing.
Right.
That's why I have put up the food chain. So you see if you remember in the UK context, food and drink manufacturing was only about 10% of the food chain. And also another sort of characteristic of the food sector, food and drink manufacturing, is this rise in so-called precarious workers. I'll explain that a bit more later. But also there tends to be, compared to other industry sectors, a higher number of employees who are a medium or low band of pay. So you can see there are some differences between different sort of industry sectors. Also, the workforce is less well qualified compared to the general working population. And again, that is reflected in other evidence, so it's just the same problem in the UK. And also, food companies generally are not very good at training, especially when it comes to making their sort of businesses more effective and efficient. they do tend to do the basic, health and safety and so on. And there's also recruitment challenges, seen as an unattractive sector for people. And as a result of that, you see that many subsectors, such as meat processing, are almost entirely reliant now upon migrant labour. Also, we have to understand, I haven't got any, this project I'm starting working on is new, we only just started on it, but you know, I haven't got too much timeline, but you know, there is a decline in jobs as well. In some areas it's been fairly static, but in food and drink manufacturing, you know, between 2000 and 2010, there's a 17% fall of in terms of number of employees. And today, around a quarter in the food and drink manufacturing sector in the UK is made up of migrant workers, predominantly from Eastern Europe. And there are sort of organisations and regulatory structures in place to help sort of protect and to monitor and the sort of working conditions of potentially vulnerable workers. And obviously, you're perhaps more familiar with this than myself, even, you know, in terms of the actual day-to-day work. But the Game Masters Licensing Authority, which was proposed in 2005 and started work in 2006. That is, you know, the sort of regulatory sort of structure in which licenses agencies, particularly for providing work in the horticultural industry and the fisheries and packing and processing. So this has a very important role in terms of trying to deal with this sort of exploitation of food workers. And currently there are around 986 licenses, and that covers around 500,000 temporary workers in the UK. But part of the work of the Gang Masters Licensing Authority is very much about, you know, tackling criminal activity. Unfortunately, in this sort of, if you like, this significant margin of the food system, it's attracted a lot of criminal activity. In 2013, for example, the Gang Masters Licensing Authority was involved in 80 ongoing investigations. And these tend to be all sorts of different types of things. And this is one quote from their chief executive. Cases can range from those who pay to enter the UK and become financially indebted to their master. They're forced to work under threats of physical or psychological violence. And in extreme cases, you know, they sort of deal with human trafficking. And there seems to be, if you look at the sort of Gang Masters Licensing Authority, seems to be a trend of this, you know, these problems increasing in this sector. And they, you know, in their annual report, they talked about a marked increase in labour exploitation. And I just want to sort of look at, you know, again, what is the nature of this exploitation in this precarious working. And I'm just going to sort of focus on very briefly on two studies. One was carried out by the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which looked at the meat and poultry processing sector. These studies are very much about qualitative work, so they're interviewing people who work on there. And this raises the other sort of problem in this sort of area, the work and role of agencies, labour agencies. And to me, this seems to be sort of one of the critical defining factors in sort of trying to sort out this problem, how these agencies work. And from this particular study in meat and poultry processing, there's evidence that agency workers are treated differently from those employed directly. So, you know, so clearly there's something, you know, right going on there. And again, in terms of, you know, different companies, some of them can, in this study, they found that it can range from 10 to even half the workforce could become through an agency. By migrant workers in the meat sector, talking about Polish, Lithuanian, Latvian, Czech, Slovakian, Portuguese. And to this particular inquiry, they said companies found it difficult to attract British workers into low-paid processing jobs, particularly working through an agency. You know, the British workers apparently didn't want to do that. Some of the reasons given for that was that apparently a lot of British people don't like handling meat anymore. The rates of pay, the working conditions, and also the physical demands, you know, intensive manual labour, long shifts. And so what has come about in the British case, 70% of workers supplied by agents are supplied by agencies to meet, 70% of workers supplied by agencies going to meat and processing are migrant labourers. So it's dominated by this system now. And the sort of problems you've seen is, you know, preventing people having toilet breaks, physical, verbal abuse, health and safety breaches, working time breaches, long hours, no time. And again, what came up again and again was the problem of language skills here, in terms of trying to sort of be able to express rights, to articulate problems. Yeah. Okay, I'm getting wound up. But I just want to make this thing: the problems noted in the meat sector were not necessarily, in terms of the working conditions, not that different from other non-food sectors that also employ high levels of low-paid agency migrant labour. Okay, so this is so I'm just going to sort of briefly talk about the Joseph Rowntree Foundation did a report on forced labour in the UK food industry, and there's a definition of forced labour, and they identified from their study risk factors. Yeah, so if you're a migrant, you're at risk, you know, being exploited, full stop. It's the type of work where you see concentrations of low-paid and demanding work. Work where there's sort of ultra-flexibility is required, particularly in the food sector, which is very seasonal and comes and goes. And also where job insecurity is chronic. You know, and even though this is not, I added this in, this is not just the food sector. You know, you've just seen that since 2010, there's been a tripling in, it's estimated, in zero-hour contracts in the sort of UK, affecting 1.4 million people. And we could perhaps see that in other parts of the food sector, perhaps in sort of retailing and catering and so on. Even in universities now, people use zero-hour contracts. So just to, I'm running out of time. What I'm trying to make is that industrial factors are important. The competition, the globalisation pressures, the sort of power of buying groups like supermarkets. You know, and again, this is a sort of an issue. Now, how much sort of leeway do supermarkets or other big corporations who engage with these suppliers and these supply chains, how much should we expect of them to improve practice, poor practice in supply chains? We also need, I would argue, better resourcing, oversight and enforcement. You know, to me, it's a little bit of a scandal. And I've seen that the Game Masters Licensing Authority budget has now been cut by almost £1 million. Yeah. And he already has a relatively small budget. So, between 2010 and sort of this current financial year. But the good news is, in the sense that the UK does have a well-established regulatory infrastructure and employment policy, but perhaps that could be sort of used or integrated in a different way to try and tackle some of these issues. Also, another thing is, which I haven't talked about, a lot of the food working areas are very regional, very concentrated. So it does raise the issue if we need a very specific, more regional or subsector strategy. And also, I would argue that we need to support greater union involvement together with other stakeholders. And also, there's business challenges here, because part of the problem is to be frank, poor business practices, lazy businesses, greedy businesses. But it also comes down to having to, businesses need to engage with better practices and management techniques. They also, in the food sector, need to invest in improving their labour productivity. If they had to do that, that could immediately improve conditions. And also, we have the fundamental problem of how rewards are distributed. So my final point is, I think we should consider, what is a decent job? What would we consider as a decent job? Thank you very much.
Thank you.